first of all, I want to just let everybody know, apparently as of this month, we've been doing these monthly mining roundups for a year, which is really cool. So we've been really happy to see how it's grown and changed, and want to thank everybody who continues to join with our, you know, really truly global industry. It's awesome to get to sit down virtually, learn from all of our different expert guests that have joined us, get folks to chat in the comments, and kind of just take a chance to talk about what's going on and what's live. With that, Alex, why don't you introduce yourself a little bit for folks who haven't met you yet?
Yeah, thanks so much, Emily. First of all, congratulations on the anniversary.
Thanks.
Keep up the great work. Thanks for so much for having me here. I'm delighted to be part of your roundup for this month. Alex Mashenko, I'm a nuclear industry, nuclear fuel cycle executive with just about 20 years of combined experience. Currently president and CEO of a small consulting business that focuses on critical intelligence gathering and dissemination of information critical for strategic decision making for U.S. Nuclear domain, civilian and defense energy sector, called Trident Maior. It is a platform to also allow a talent to enter the force, and perhaps instead of turning this into a temporary gig, we're providing for a very deep, knowledge-centered opportunities for them to have a deep institutional dive into nuclear fuel cycle and formulate a very confident awareness of where our industry is headed.
Yeah, and I know even just on that talent side, we've talked a lot about that. Like, how do you get folks to come in and join in on the fun? Because it's not always at the top of folks' lists that they're thinking about.
Particularly in the current times when we're pivoting, it seems, towards focusing on domestic markets, tapping into indigenous talent and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and Alex, you joined our podcast On the Rocks for our Uranium 101 episode, which was so great. So that's where we thought it would be so fitting to have you on this month, because we're starting out Q2 and we're 2 months post PDAC. And there are still lots of rumblings around that uranium is the new hot commodity of 2024, duking it out, fighting for that title with lithium and now gold with gold prices. So wanted to back up a little bit and give folks some of that context. Before we talk present and the future of uranium, let's go back a little bit in time and talk about the dawn of uranium in the U.S. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Certainly. No, you're absolutely right. I think we will all collectively benefit from understanding the fundamentals of how our industry came to be. What are the origins and past and present bottlenecks in order to extrapolate the recipes for future success? As our space, you mentioned uranium is now being back in favor, that certainly contributed to a lot of more attention coming from across the board, from different platforms. And as the platforms get joined in, I think the conversation gets louder and louder and more inclusive. But with that comes a patina of misinformation and misaligned information. So in order to do that confidently, I think we need to look into the past. Mm-hmm. Obviously, nuclear energy was coming on the heels of victorious status of United States coming out of World War II. And the peaceful atom was looked at collectively by the defense industry as well as the private sector. And in order to foster the local production and create climate for commercial success, I think between 1948 and roughly between 1948 and 1970, a very positive environment was created in the United States through the instruments of agencies that fostered local development of mines. I think at one point during the peak in 1950s, we had roughly around 750 mines in operation. And without fully appreciating the importance of where we were and how much of actual work that had been done domestically to motivate our industry to grow, we really cannot appreciate where we are today. So, brief history, U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, or AEC, was formed and operated on both realms of the industry, the private and the DoD sector, between roughly 1948 and 1970. And that provided for an excellent, fruitful environment, I should say, for New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado Plateau, Wyoming, and a number of other jurisdictions. For the most part, the open pit sandstone deposits that were actively being mined at the time were successfully depleted and distributed as part of the DoD programs and a growing patterned construction of civilian nuclear power plants across the board. So by the time we reached mid to late 70s, I think we were in a position where the AEC was sufficiently satisfied with the inventory buildup that was distributed for the DoD and the civilian applications. And with the termination of the agency, I think we had entered a new phase that we will hopefully talk about a little bit of pivoting the focus of natural uranium production from domestic to looking at alternative sources globally.
Yeah, and I mean, I know a lot of folks, they think of uranium and in general, they just think of bad, right? But I think folks really underestimate how much it created this energy space and, you know, all the different ways that it's used internationally. So with that being said, you know, with the U.S. having been focused so much on uranium in the past, like, why did it stop? Like, what gave us the peace of mind as a country? And I know there are a lot of folks watching that aren't here in the U.S., but maybe what would cause a country to stop focusing on uranium production and think like, oh, everybody else has got it taken care of?
There's no definitive and simple answer to that question. Well, commercial purchases remained strong, and our civilian nuclear power plant sector by 1970s were humming at unprecedented levels. I think AEC essentially dropped that combined purchasing initiative, number one, because the federal government decided to move away from the direct participation in the private sector. And again, the decision was made that collectively the federal government had acquired enough strategic reserves. So entering into 1980s, there was a rocky time when certain incidents had occurred in the industry, including Three Mile Island incident, followed by the Chernobyl disaster. And so uranium and nuclear, although did not fall out of favor, it was certainly not a widely talked about subject that did not occupy the same space and the same attention that it previously did. So during that time, there was sufficient operations in friendly jurisdictions, and at the end of the Cold War, we had found ourselves facing a relatively unexpected additional source for natural uranium component. And that is, after the breakup of Soviet Union, we had entered into an agreement with the government of Russia for reprocessing the wartime arsenal of nuclear warheads. It was a program that spanned roughly 30 years, called Megatons to Megawatts, and it allowed the United States to enter the space of repurposing Russian nuclear warheads and extracting additional natural uranium component out of reprocessing services that came along with that.
I just can't imagine that agreement happening today.
Indeed. Completely different times we're living in.
Like, look, guys, here's how we're going to do this.
right.
We're going to let the Russians take the stuff out of their warheads, and we're going to use that. Yeah.
So that was just a small. Go ahead.
That's kind of surprising, even politically, even at that time, like how folks could sell that.
Yeah, I think the aspirations and the hopes were running high about the transformative nature of freedom washing over the former Soviet Union realm. You had very positive signals coming from Ukraine and Central Asian country of Kazakhstan that were in the business of nuclear nuclear weapons and nuclear research by voluntarily giving up their nuclear arsenal. Ukraine and Kazakhstan were back then widely known for being the pioneers of voluntarily walking away from being associated with the nuclear weapons programs. And so things were looking rosy and very promising in that realm. And on the pretty substantial foundation of the Soviet nuclear program, there were a lot of interesting projects that folks favorably looked upon in co-developing nuclear processing services and doing business together. I will remind you, Emily, that there are only two industries or sectors, I should say, that remained untouched by the broad application of sanctions at the moment that we have against Russia, and that is space and nuclear energy. We continue to cooperate in those realms, and that's largely sitting on those pillars and the initial close agreements and understanding that people found through the 90s in extending that that leap of faith.
And I mean, did that also happen at the same time that just the appetite for mining in the U.S. domestically kind of took a nosedive? Was that part of it also, where it was like kind of the offshoring of uranium mining was convenient from that perspective?
Yes, I think it was largely dictated by the economics. You know, globalization was gaining steam at the time. Mm-hmm. For a moment, it seemed that it no longer was relevant where you get the material, right? As long as it was a commercially viable opportunity. And on the heels of that concept, I think there was a lot of venture engineering, venture mining expertise that went out into jurisdictions that had a lot of mining potential, like Central Asia, a predominantly strong ore body presence for uranium concentrates, and looked for ways to optimize existing production. Mm-hmm. And that put countries like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan on the map as internationally acknowledged producers. That eventually made Kazakhstan the number one producer in the world, and Uzbekistan, with their tweaking and fine-tuning operations, is confidently making steps towards ramping up their production. So, you know, the money and the attention went to the lowest hanging fruit, and it also had to do with the emergence of the ISR method of extraction, and that's in situ mm-hmm. recovery. That is an environmentally relatively benign method where you interact with the ore body through submersible pumps and submersible wells and extract pregnant solution and work on the refinement on the surface. So those new jurisdictions that popped up on the map, like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, offered tremendous amount of commercially feasible opportunities to get the material out of the ground. And so the world's attention, being geopolitically neutral, naturally shifted towards those jurisdictions.
And who developed that in situ processing tech, Alex? Was that developed in those countries?
No, it was partially, but it was a collective effort. Kazakhstan is a very interesting example in sort of offering a platform for multiple principles and multiple technologies to come and compete. Historically, they were known and continue to be known as a very forward-thinking location for you know, top uranium producers of the world to come in and relatively openly set up operations, even though their principles of extractions may differ from one another. They've been known for offering mining rights to a Canadian entity, Cameco, one of the top producing companies out there, to Japanese uranium producers, to French Orano, formerly Areva, and a number of others.
Very cool. That's why I'm always amazed at who comes up with all that stuff.
Of course, you refine the principles depending on your soil composition and access to critical components like sulfuric acid and submersible pump technology.
So with all of that, that kind of leads us up to today. And from your perspective, what is the real situation that we find ourselves in with uranium? And what are some of those challenges? And is the real situation any different from maybe the chatter and the perceived situation?
The current situation, best I would describe it, is the very unlikely multiple black swan event, and that had to do with multiple dominoes falling. The first domino being COVID pandemic, I think. It allowed a lot of folks to very soberly look at the integrity of their supply chain composition. To producers on the ground, it meant probably curtailing their operations in maintaining regular man hours. And it also had to do with the initial components being delivered to the sites, right? Like sulfuric acid, we talked about SR, open pit, same deal with man hours required for mining operations and so forth. It started on the production side from limited access to resources and manpower, but on the consumer side, let's call them utilities, right? Because those are the major consumers of our product. It meant a very deep dive in understanding where the material is coming from. And so that was the first domino. Second domino very quickly after that, and that is Russia's invasion in Ukraine, and a multitude of sanctions or near sanction circumstances, right? That created additional vulnerabilities to supply chains in terms of how we move the material. We briefly touched upon, the warming up of the relations between the U.S. and Russia during early 90s, after the Berlin Wall fell. And that essentially snowballed into the current situation where roughly 41% of conversion and enrichment services are being pipelined from the Russian producers into the world market, right? Almost overnight, you end up in a situation where you're having to reassess where your vulnerabilities are and how you readjust your procurement strategies going forward. Add to the fact that if we are talking about jurisdictions that put themselves confidently on the map in terms of uranium production, like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, they all of a sudden found themselves on the opposite spectrum of the potentially sanctioned area. Mm-hmm. And although they're applying monumental efforts to mitigate the risks right now in devising ways to find alternative delivery routes, for example, through Trans-Caspian route, avoiding either Russian pipeline altogether or being associated with Russian delivery companies, shipping companies, et cetera. The tools that are at their disposal, particularly given where they are having to operate, are extremely limited. So that second domino kind of exacerbated the situation that we were already falling into as a result of COVID and overstrained global supply chains. The third domino is sort of self-made, and that is the euphoria and the positive vibe that we discovered in the Western Hemisphere over the promise of nuclear. It is all of a sudden everybody's favorite subject to talk about, everybody's darling. But on the heels of that, Emily, there was a very robust conversation for improving, you know, sovereign nuclear policies and energy programs that included new builds, that included new nuclear power plants that are scheduled for construction in the long term. So that led to a lot of folks to start to crunch the numbers, to do the math. And, you know, with that potential new demand on the one side, that meant that additional material had to come from somewhere. And with our domestic operations, you know, falling out of favor for multiple decades and only now regaining popularity, and all these vulnerabilities that we talked about arising from the top performers of the world, that put us in a very, very difficult situation in terms of untangling the factors that might contribute to a quick or deployable solutions, right? And that's where we find ourselves in at the moment. So in order to understand how to effectively and efficiently pivot from the current situation, we need to understand to what degree we will rely on the trusted suppliers going forward, you know, who our allies and foes are in this new battle for resources, if you will, and who will ultimately be their reliable partners in a comprehensive energy policy that requires new nuclear power plants, new nuclear reactors being put in operation, and the pipeline of nuclear fuel related services that needs to be part of that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great example of, at least from a U.S. perspective. I've chatted about this on the podcast before. Like, we as the United States need to decide, like, are we just trying to solve a supply issue, or are we trying to grow our own domestic solution, right? Those are two very different problem sets that require very different policies and implementation. And I know you touched on it a little bit, but you and I over lunch last week, you were explaining to me like the Trans-Caspian network and like so many of these constraints. It's not just, like you said, about who's mining it, but the logistics networks become tied in with sanctions in this region so much. And again, I know you mentioned it a little bit, but could you drill into that a little bit? Because I don't think that's something that folks really understand how.
Yeah, sure. So when you're talking about delivery of uranium concentrates or any type of material related to the nuclear fuel cycle, that's being classified as generally as a class 7 material that requires a plethora of regulations, pre-certifications, and pre-audited routes. Correct. That are pre-authorized to handle sensitive type of material, right? Yeah. And so traditionally, and over the course of many decades, that tried and true route existed for mining companies out of Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and even for transshipping some of the material from China ultimately to their European customers through the port of St. Petersburg, through Russia. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can visualize the map of Eurasia, you cannot talk global deliveries without talking Russia. That's just the way the railway network, limited as it is, has been configured for many years. And so with the current context of geopolitical woes, I think folks are gradually factoring out the plausibility of St. Petersburg continuing to play that role for a lot of shipping companies and producers. And as an alternative to that delivery route, you know, countries and individual companies have looked long and hard at Trans-Caspian delivery opportunity. And then that would involve physical deliveries to the port, to the Kazakh port across the Caspian Basin, to port of Baku in Azerbaijan, and eventually through the Caucasus, including Georgia, and either over Black Sea, over the safe jurisdiction, essentially sort of skirting the territorial waters of Turkey, or by land through the same country, through Turkey, to European ports, destinations, and customers, or ultimately to North America. The challenge with that alternative is the fact that Caspian Sea is a landlocked lake. And for a very long time, the infrastructure inside of that territory had been limited to local agents only. It has not been put on the map, logistically speaking, for major international insurance underwriters, for major shipbuilders, for freight companies that typically would, or, you know, would engage in tackling complicated issues such as this. And so because of the urgency and the pace at which problems needed to have been addressed and solved, folks from Kazakhstan, Kazatomprom particularly, in a handful of local jurisdictions, including a number of ministries that had to be involved in the conversation over time, had to draw up plans very quickly to make sure that those deliveries eventually happen. And, talking about limited resources and experience, again, 100% commending the effort and the amount of talent that went into making it happen. But from a purely logistical and economic standpoint, given the limitations of the region at this time, I think the tools are extremely limited to turn it into a viable wide artery to pipeline, you know, every under-delivered or every pound that is currently in jeopardy of not finding home in the West.
So where do you see kind of the money moving in this space, or how do you see all of this interest in uranium and everybody kind of recognizing these challenges? Like, what do you think might happen?
I think the money is tight pretty much across the board. I think you, having been very intimately involved in the mining industry in general, you understand that with
not much capital,
the economic situation, everything just got more expensive. And in order to free up resources and financial commitments of any meaningful financial player, you have to have a very meaningful conversation, and you better have a long-term plan and long-term solution. So where do those solutions come from? Probably from the friendlier jurisdictions, particularly considering the turbulent times. Washington is having a challenging time defining what those jurisdictions might look like. We have yet to categorize the reliability scale for uranium suppliers globally. We have not put our partners, existing or prospective, on the map from that point of view. But I think as far as lowest hanging fruits, I think Athabasca Basin of Canada is showing tremendous amount of potential. Existing operations, obviously spearheaded by Cameco, but also ISO Energy and a handful of other operators who have respectable reputations in Australia and other places that are still in the process of entering Canadian space, I think are very promising bids. Domestic operations in the U.S., supported and buttressed by Uranium Producers of America, and also the conversation that is being had in this town, I think will be an interesting addition and hopefully a great participant into making up for any potential shortfalls. There's a handful of jurisdictions out of Africa that are robust in their integrity of the mine sector, but certain questions need to be first addressed as to the commitment and the integrity of their political regimes and everything that comes on the heels of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really funny because, like, just basically we haven't really determined who our friends are right now, right? It's kind of like we're in the middle school clique stage of like who are we okay with, and you know, that maybe is changing day to day, which makes it really hard to assess where this stuff might go. And I was just in the background pulling up on Prospector, and we've got like 575 uranium projects that we track on Prospector. But if we were to just say, you know, let's look at North America, just from a U.S. perspective, or maybe just even the U.S., you know, it narrows that down quite a bit, right? If we were to head towards it, we've got 151 projects that have uranium in them, right, just here in the U.S. So there's certainly, you know, there's a lot of projects out there, but how quickly can you bring them into feasibility and production in order to kind of answer these questions is the other big challenge.
That's correct. Yeah. Tremendous amount of time needs to be spent in that space in connecting the dots between the deployability of a mine and the level of interest on the investor community side. The existing mines within the list of UPA, Uranium Producers of America, I think are way on their way to prove themselves scalable and deployable. But at the same time, you're right. There are smaller operations that are mushrooming up on the heels of this rediscovered wave of positive news. Question is, how long the initiative is able to linger until it gets completely funded, right? Morphs into the actual operation.
Yeah. Well, and on that, and I would encourage anybody, if you want, shoot, you know, questions or comments, they're on LinkedIn. Sometimes we do have a little bit of a technical glitch on that. So if you've sent something in and we haven't seen it, just send it again. But I wonder, Alex, we mentioned at the beginning kind of the brain drain aspect of this and the lack of talent. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. What are you seeing? What needs to be done to support the uranium and nuclear power industry?
I think you start early. We've seen tremendous amount of success of STEM programs and their effect on unaffiliated but equally important business domestically, and that is airspace and defense. Places like Orlando, Florida have tremendous amount of or allocated tremendous amount of resources to make airspace domain fun, engaging, and intriguing to younger kids as far back as early as middle school, right? And so on the heels of that STEM centered school system, I think you just generate a speck of interest, and then you continue to foster it by engaging local professionals, by bringing in folks who spend tremendous amount of time in the industry and talk about the tremendous amount of potential that uranium mining domestically can free up, and the careers that it can foster. And you graduate this generation into great institutions of higher learning like Colorado School of Mines, and you pour more attention into specific programs that concentrate on uranium extraction and kind of learning the newest trends. I think the results of ISR centered operations in Canada and in Central Asia are a perfect example of industry coming together in solving very complex issues. These things need to be carefully preserved and communicated to the younger generation. I think that's where we need to be spending a lot of professional time and commitment in the next couple of decades, if not longer, because a lot of precious time has been lost in the 90s. We need to play catch up very quickly.
Yeah, and I think I mean, I also think that for young folks or people taking a look at the industry, it's a very unique commodity because in uranium, you go really direct from the mineral to fuel, right? Like, I mean, it's a very small, like a shorter communication chain, supply chain between the suppliers and the buyers, where, you know, where you don't necessarily see that in a lot of other parts of the mining industry. So for some folks, that could be really appealing. Like you're really more integrated into the actual use of the material than you would be with a lot of other minerals and commodities.
Correct. I think, unfortunately, there's a patina of secrecy that back then came with uranium mining because of a dual use of the material. But as we moved along through the late 20th century, I think commercial application of uranium had dominated the space, and we had largely walked away from the secrecy part, right? But at the same time, we had failed to communicate that extremely short communication environment between a person who is responsible for extracting uranium and the person who is directly benefiting from purchasing that uranium concentrate, being the nuclear power plant, a utility procurement officer, and so forth. That is truly unique. I'm glad you mentioned that. I think that truly puts uranium on a map as a very unique commodity in that each side of the business is capable to see the application of its product through. Utilities are capable to understand, if they wish, the intricacies of getting the stuff out of the ground and all the logistics that is associated with bringing it over to them and turning it into fuel. And then the extracting industry is benefiting from talking to the end customer and seeing the end result of where the material is ending up.
Yeah. Well, with that, if anybody has any questions or comments, throw those in. And Alex, any kind of last thoughts on what we should be paying attention to within the uranium space over the next few months? No stock tips. We don't promote any any specific company or anything. But yeah, any things that you think folks aren't aware of with all of this excitement? I mean, I think what I find interesting is I'm starting to see exploration happen at uranium projects again. And I know, you know, money's still tight, right? And it's still hard for juniors to raise money for any kind of exploration projects. But the fact that we've seen some uranium projects come out with some cool updates, that work is going on, I think that's just something new that I haven't seen over the last few years, that folks are actually out there looking for uranium again. I think is a great sign that the interest and the chatter is starting to trickle down to actually putting geologist boots on the ground again.
Absolutely true. You know, we talked about the dominoes falling into creating this mess that we're currently finding ourselves in, but equal is also true in a handful of things are happening simultaneously to almost create a perfect storm for paying attention more to domestic uranium mining. With price recovery, I think you're looking at more feasible situation where you would entertain the possibility of domestic production, be it in the U.S. or Canada or any other friendly jurisdictions. It helps to pave through the discovery, the allocation of initial research and probing, and exist in an environment where everybody at least hopes substantially that the higher prices are here to stay. And that is a tremendous booster of confidence for the investor community that are looking at it as a long-term investor opportunity.
All right. Well, with that, if anyone's got any last questions or comments, we went a little bit over our half hour, but Alex and I can talk for much, much longer. So send any other questions. And if not, we will look forward to seeing you all again. And Jess put in the comments, if anyone can see them or can't find them, you can go to the LinkedIn conversation. We did have Alex on the Rocks before, so you can find the link to his podcast episodes, as well as a uranium project report that we did. If you're looking to kind of get an overview of uranium projects globally, it's a free download. It's a little bit old, but if you subscribe to our Prospector weekly newsletter, The Nugget, we keep every report that comes out, we capture in that newsletter, so you can see if there are new uranium projects. And of course, you can sign up for a free trial for Prospector at prospectorportal.com and check out all of the uranium projects we have and everything else.